right. Good morning. I'm glad to see you all bright and early. And this is session number 316. We'll make the air with you, music ring. My name is Christine Haglund, and I'm going to moderate, direct, and hopefully not sing too loudly because we have actual singers here. And you. Unlike much of the Mormon tradition, Mormon hymnody started fully assimilated into the American Protestant tradition, right? Because it was borrowed whole cloth at first, and then became distinctive over the years rather than other aspects of Mormonism, which have started out very distinctive and became assimilated. And so this morning we're going to just explore a little bit of the ground, the tradition from which that early Mormon hymnody sprang, and then mostly we're going to just sing. I am fairly certain that there are no original thoughts in my presentation. I have borrowed copiously, that is, plagiarized shamelessly, from Michael Hicks' excellent book, Mormonism in Music. If you haven't read this and you like music at all, even if you don't like music at all, read this book. It's really an astonishing book, both about music and about Mormonism. He manages to work in a lot of really wonderful insights about the church. The other book that I've borrowed a lot from is Stephen Marini's book called Sacred Song in America, which has a whole chapter on Mormons and has both Come Come Ye Saints and Janis Kat Perry's I Walk by Faith in the appendices. So if that doesn't pique your interest, I don't know what would. And finally, I've relied a lot on Kurt Kammeyer's excellent little collection called The Harp of Nauvoo, in which he's tried to sort of, with the best available evidence we have, match tunes and texts from the early days of the church. And sometimes we don't know, and so he's just guessed, and he has excellent taste in sacred harp tunes, and he's guessed good ones. So it's also a wonderful resource. In the early American music tradition, there was some tension between devotion to an informal style where emotion and sincerity and spontaneity were prized, and what was called regular singing, which was, or singing by note, which was learning music, actually sometimes rehearsing a choir. There was actually a great deal of controversy, particularly among the Methodists, about whether there should ever be a choir or whether the congregation should all sing together. The Palmyra Methodist Church, however, did have a choir that rehearsed somewhat regularly, and I, having been a choir director for most of my life, a ward choir director, I think this tension still plays out, right? There's always a lot of people who seem to think that emotion and sincerity are more important than rehearsal, and it's a constant struggle. So the Methodists favored regular singing, and during the 18th and even before that a little bit, there were a lot of singing schools during the 18th century, that is. A lot of different ways to try to teach music to everyone so that people could participate. And the most widespread and popular of these was called shape note singing. If you'll flip to the back of that packet. No, actually not the back, sorry. The second page. I have mine all out of order. There are some more, although I think we're going to run out, which is a delightful problem to have, more people than music. So these shape notes had different shapes according to their place on the scale, which was meant so that people could know the relative pitches even if they didn't know the names of the pitches. And this spread throughout the northern states, through New England, and eventually to the south. And now the tradition is carried on mostly in the south. I just want to read you a little description of sacred harp singing, which is still a vibrant tradition in many areas of the south, and even in New England. There's a huge Sacred Harp Sing in Western Massachusetts that I went to last year, where 300 or 400 people, sometimes more, come and sing all day. You stand in a square. I've sort of tried to reproduce the shape a little bit, although it's actually a full square, and the leader stands in the middle, and you just sing all day, and it's incredible. So let me just read you Marini's description of one such gathering. Normally, the congregation numbers fewer than 20 members. This is at the Little Vine Primitive Baptist Church. But on a sultry Sunday morning in mid-June, nearly 100 men, women, and children crowded into the church for Little Vine's annual singing of the Sacred Harp. On this day, two front pews had been reversed to face the congregation. Three more pews had been drawn up perpendicularly on each side of the front pews. This arrangement cleared a hollow square roughly 10 by 10 feet. Three large fans produced a semblance of cross ventilation in the steaming building, and a large cooler of ice water stood on the table at the rear of the church. We got that. Sorry, Ben. By mid-morning, enough singers had arrived to begin. Again, we got that. Those singing the melody or lead part sat facing the pulpit. Most of the lead singers were men, joined by women who sang the melody an octave above. Opposite the leads sat the altos or counters, all women. Basses gathered to the left of the leads, with sopranos or trebles, a mixed group of women and men in roughly inverse proportion to the leads assembled to their right. At the beginning of the singing, there were perhaps 12 lead singers and 6 on each of the other parts. By mid-afternoon, the number had doubled. Shortly after 10 o'clock, Harrison Creel, a distinguished elder of the church, moved to the center of the hollow square and called the community to order by announcing the first hymn. "Let's begin with page 30 top," he said. While 30 pairs of hands opened their red oblong tune books to the correct tune, Thomas Waller's Love Divine, Creel pitched the tonic note of the tune without the aid of a pitch pipe. The singers quickly sounded the first note of their respective parts. Harrison immediately dropped the downbeat, his right hand flat and fully extended, beating time with a simple up and down movement. And then he writes a little note about the sound. One thing is that the singing is just loud. It's incredibly loud. People sing as loud as they can. And so sometimes it's not pretty, but it's very potent. Here's what it says. "These people do not produce the round tone and vibrato typical of white church choirs. They produce a flat, piercing vocal tone without vibrato. As in other sacred choral traditions, the Russian Orthodox, for example, each part has a specific tone quality and tuning. The basses rumble low and resonant, then stretch out for high phrases reaching beyond middle C. The lead melody line routinely rises to F, G, and even A above middle C, all brought with the full-throated force that sometimes shades over into pure shout. Trebles, on the other hand, tend to float lightly on their harmony part, its range even higher than the leads." Sorry, guys. "Altos, taxed with the least melodically interesting part." Some things have not changed over the centuries. "Make a virtue of necessity by creating subtle tunings for those few notes." So I'm an alto. Yeah, subtle tunings, that's us. "Often they will sing their harmony slightly flat or sharp, lending an archaic modal sound to the ensemble." I'd say that in Mormon congregations, they tend to only sing slightly flat. So feel free to sing slightly sharp this morning if you'd like. "Lending an archaic modal sound to the ensemble. And they deliver all of this with a laser-like chest tone quality that could shatter glass." So sing loud, sing heavy. There was, even with among the Mormons, who mostly followed the Methodist tradition, and as I said, the Palmyra Methodist Church had a choir. The Presbyterians also had choirs, so both of the major influences on Joseph and Emma allowed choirs in their traditions, but there was still some doubt about it. The Campbellites absolutely did not allow choirs, so that large faction that joined the church sort of militated against that. I grew up in Nashville with Campbellites, and they still don't. They're called the Church of Christ now, one faction of them that's in Nashville, and they still don't have choirs, but man, can their congregation sing. They don't use any instruments or accompaniment, and they really sing. So there are some benefits to dissolving the word choir and mixing them in. However, even at the time of the Kirtland Temple dedication, there was still questions and arguments. There were arguments about whether there should be a choir, and in fact, Joseph Smith wrote in his journal that just, I think, a couple of weeks before the dedication, I'm not going to find it, but he set up a music committee for the church after a good deal of altercation, is what his thing said. But that seemed to have sort of settled the question for Mormons, at least, that there would be choirs, and there, as you know, have continued to be. Although, even this is one of the things that's wonderful about this book is that there are these really subtle one-liners in here. And so the difficulty of establishing the choir tradition is pointed to by this sentence. Called to be caretaker for the temple, Phelps, that's William Wines Phelps, W.W., hosted the Mormon emigrants who occasionally passed through on their way to Nauvoo and played the part of the choir master, often standing alone in one of the choir galleries and singing solo. As I said, some things have not changed in the church. So that established the choir tradition, and then Brigham Young felt very strongly that people should be trained to sing by note, and he actually called missionaries to go to places and to teach people singing. He had traveling singing masters, and there was actually some effort to make sure that each colonizing group that was sent out had some musicians in it, which, again, would be wise to reproduce in our current church. All right, so with that, let's start singing. The first tune that you have is called Northfield, and it's an early... I don't have it. I'll need to get a copy of the music. It's an early... it's in the Sacred Harp now, but it's an early New England tune. And it's an example of what's called a fuguing tune, which opens with a section in four-part homophony, which is where all the parts move at the same time. And then there's a fuguing section where each part comes in on an identical or similar vocal line at a different time. So like a fugue or a round. For those of you who came in late, come up here. We're going to start singing, and you need to be up here. So we've got sopranos mostly on this side, and you can pull up more chairs, and altos over there, tenors and basses. Get on up here. I think just for this one first tune, I'll play for a minute so that you can hear, and once we get settled in, we won't have piano.
I don't know this piece.
Yeah. You have to stand in the middle.
In the middle.
In the middle, and you don't have to be beat.
Yes,
but you can do that if you want. And we do the even though your Mormon choir director has begged you over and over not to do this, in Sacred Heart singing you do get to sound the first note of your choir before you start. So the
basis.
Everybody.
Everybody.
is a Mormon speaking tune, an angel from on high. Let me play just the melody once. Katie, you want to join me?
Oh,
I'm a terrible person. I neglected to introduce the members of Fiddlesticks. If you were here last night, you watched hear them. So their thing was magnificent. This is Marco Vegas and Katie Henderson, is that right? And Rebecca Stevens. And both Katie and Rebecca are dances in the origin.
If anyone would like to do this, feel free to come.
I will admit.
Okay, good.
I think maybe come over. All right, so here's the melody of this. It's in the tenor line, and I guess, just in the tenor line.
You want to just play it?
Three, four.
Thank you.
Tim's got the sweet spot for the
Are we better than your worst partner?
You are. Their sister Liz conducts it, so I can't see. It's excellent.
Well, that implies that the answer didn't.
Good. All right. This next part is a tune that you don't know. So, that you guys can do this, right? Want to listen to you once? The mainstream part here?
The
mainstream. How about if, Rebecca, will you sing the first verse and then we'll join in for the.
Thank you.
we've changed that. The next one I put in just because I love it, and it sort of goes with the time period, right? You all know the story about a four-way pair and then a two-way son in Carthage, so that fits. This is an example of early text of John Taylor's with a later tune in a completely different style. This is from the old Blue Moon and I'll play, and you guys can do whatever you want. And we don't really need a chorus because it turns out, as you all know, that no one ever actually follows it. My favorite story is that once I was directing kids in student conference and I fainted, like passed out cold on the stand, and nothing happened.
Clearly inspired by an older tune.
although the legend is undoubtedly has elements of Henry Clayton, received word that he had a daughter born healthy, and that was the impetus for composing the museum. So we have good reason to go back to that text and that too. Do you know the original text?
Well, the original text?
Yeah.
This one?
No, the...
What was that? Original music?
No, this is original music, but the, what's this, my...
It's a Kurtz book.
Yeah. Is it? But no, because this is... No, I copied this from there, so the text isn't.
Sorry.
That's okay.
What do you think about the... It's all about
that. It's all about that. Yeah, we've seen it with me. So whatever. Alright, so this is the death to my daughter.
Thank you.
So this is for the dedication of the Kirtland Temple. It says, meeting two evenings a week, the temple singing school consisted of any saints who had interest. Its members were neither called nor hired. Surprise, surprise. Adolescent and adult saints, from the young adult to the old gray heads, began rehearsing six texts from Emma's collection. 10 days before the temple dedication, Joseph visited the group's Wednesday night rehearsal and cryptically recorded in his diary that they performed admirably considering the advantages they have had. When dedication day arrived, the choir must have been astonishingly large, numbering perhaps 200, since it appears to have filled the temple singers' galleries. There were probably fewer than 250 families living in Kirtland at the time. According to Joseph Smith's description of the event, the choir needed at least three music leaders to direct it. No doubt. No doubt to cope with the spatial arrangement of the group. The choir seats are sort of in all four corners of the Kirtland Temple, I think. Or three? They're all four, yeah. Its singing profoundly stirred the congregation and, according to some accounts, brought down angels. So accustomed was the church to singing with the Spirit that some of the congregation believed that Phelps's new hymn, The Spirit of God, was given by God on the spot when it was sung to the tune of the well-known Now Let Us Rejoice. It seemed a kind of interpretation without tongues. So, let's do it.
Did you say it was sung to the tune of Now Let Us Rejoice?
Yeah.
Sounds real to know. I think it's Richard Collier from the Kingdom of Christ said that now let us rejoice in something. So now let us rejoice in something. And he's put together, I'm coming up from the history of the Kirtland a few years ago, but the whole thing, all the way in there, was sung at the death of the
Kirtland.
Yeah. You have that whole thing.
Yeah, so there's some dispute over which one. Okay, let's do the one we know. And stand up. And we're going to do all the verses. There's good stuff in there. Thank you.
Amen.